right. Greetings, everyone. Welcome to the Law Hour. The Law Hour is sponsored by Truth Radio Network. It's an educational service in the public interest. I'm your host, George Gordon. Now, the Law Hour is heard nationally 7 days a week on Truth Radio and worldwide on the Internet. For more information about the Law Hour and the Gordon Law School, please go to my website. That's georgegordon.org. That's georgegordon.org. Now, the Law Hour brings you important information about law, news, and current events. So stay tuned for tonight's special report on Great American Trials right after this break. You know, in 1787, the writers of our Constitution put in this clause at Article 1, Section 10. It says, "No state shall make anything but gold or silver coin a tender in payment of debt." Now, that clause follows the biblical injunction on just weights and balances that we find in Leviticus 19, verses 35 and 36. Now, private business is carried on in gold and silver coin. Public business is conducted in commercial paper. Commercial paper, like stocks, bonds, Federal Reserve notes, credit cards, and debt usury. Well, back in 1965, Congress told us that there is no difference in the value of gold and silver coin and clad coin or currency. And that's very true when we're dealing with banks, government, and commercial industries. But out here in the real marketplace, there's a 7-to-1 difference in purchasing power, and there's a 7-to-1 difference in the taxes due on that paper money versus gold money. Now, you know, God and our founding fathers did not give us gold and silver coin for no good purpose. They knew that as a matter of law, gold and silver coin was absolutely necessary for you and I to deal in order for us to establish our property rights. And neither did our Congress and politicians take our gold and silver coin away from us back in 1933 for no good reason either. They knew, and they knew full well, that in order to subjugate a free people, they would have to first take away their gold and silver coin in order to take away the people's right to property and to destroy their property rights, and they did that under the first plank to the Communist Manifesto. Now, if you and I intend to regain our rights, duties, and capacities, then we must first regain our property and property rights, and that's because property is the legal foundation of all of our liberties. Now, let me teach you how to do just that. This business school is now on compact disc for adult homeschool. Now, for more information about my private business school, why don't you call first and order my free general law CD package? Now, that's a 4-hour commentary on the law in general. It's informative, it's entertaining, it's educational, and it's free of charge. You can call right now to order yours. The number is 417-273-4967. Remember, my business school is also available on compact disc for adult home study. If you're online, go to the website. It's georgegordon.org. Click onto the email machine and send me an email request for your free general law CD package. Remember, that's georgegordon.org, or call direct 417-273-4967. All right, last time we were talking, we were involved in self-defense with a guy by the name of Goetz. We've taken a look at the Fifth Amendment, Ponzi schemes, interrogation, self-defense, taxes, medicine. Let's take a look at immunity from prosecution. How do you get immunity anyway? Remember a guy by the name of Oliver North? Well, Oliver North was a Marine major or a colonel, and he worked for President Reagan. He got involved in a thing called the Iran-Contra controversy. I'm not sure that I really understand all that I know about Iran-Contra, but it was quite a scandal. You know, most administrations have their scandals, like the Clinton administration and now the Bush administration. Well, the Reagan team had a guy by the name of Oliver North, and he did some things that were illegal. Well, he wasn't the only guy that was involved in illegal activities in the Reagan White House. So Congress invited Oliver North to come up on the Hill and testify concerning what he knew concerning these irregularities, the scandal, these criminal activities that were going on, like the Nixon people, breaking into the Watergate complex. They invited Oliver North to come up there and explain about this Iran-Contra thing. And so Oliver North did. He went up to the Capitol Hill and they said, well, now listen, we want you to tell us this story. We want you to tell us about what happened here in this Iran-Contra thing. And if you do that, you come clean, fess up, tell us what happened. We won't prosecute you. We will give you a get-out-of-jail-free card. We will give you immunity from prosecution. Remember the immunity card. You may want that someday if you were talking to the police or a prosecutor. You don't want to talk, and the prosecutor says, well, gee, we'll give you immunity. Make sure that you get it in writing now. You got to have a piece of paper here. Prosecutors are prone to lie a lot. And they'll promise you the moon, but if you're not smart enough to get it in writing, then when they come into court or they come into the forum, they say, well, we don't know anything about immunity. We never offered that to you. So remember, in the business world, you have to get it in writing, and if you're dealing in the judicial world, you have to get it in writing also. Well, North did that. North got immunity. It was on the record. These were televised C-SPAN type hearings, and it was publicly given to Oliver North, immunity from prosecution. Well, when he got through, he confessed to a number of indiscretions, and when the thing was over, the Justice Department came out and prosecuted him anyway. And the thing that got North was that he had to go in and spend $500,000. This was his complaint. He spent $500,000 defending himself. Let's take a look at the essentials of this case and see whether or not we really need to spend $500,000 or $500 or $50 or nothing to defend yourself when you got to get out of jail free card. In 1985, the administration of President Ronald Reagan embarked on a plan to secure the release of American hostages by illegally selling arms to Iran. Funds from those sales were channeled to the Contra guerrillas down in Nicaragua, who were attempting to overthrow that country's leftist government. So when news of this deal broke in 1986, a congressional hearing followed. Under promise of immunity, get that, under promise of immunity, Oliver North, a Marine Corps Lieutenant Colonel and member of President Reagan's National Security Council, provided an account of the U.S. government's role. North's emotional performance captured the public imagination, but it left some doubts about his veracity. So a grand jury later charged him with having lied to Congress, obstructed justice, and received kickbacks. Jury selection and other legal gyrations delayed opening arguments until February 21, 1988. And Chief Prosecutor John Kiker laid out the government's case, alleging that North had shredded documents and altered computer records, knowing them to be vital to the Iran-Contra investigation, before visiting U.S. Attorney General Edwin Meese III. There, he met with the Attorney General and some of his top assistants, and when they asked him questions about something very important to know, he lied. Now, the evidence in this case is going to show that these were crimes, and the reason for these crimes was that Colonel North was covering up crimes that he'd already committed. Now, you'd have thought that the North defense team would have filed a motion to dismiss for failure of the state to prove its prima facie case based upon the get-out-of-free-jail card. You'd have thought. Maybe they did. I'm not quite sure. You'd have thought North would have testified to the grand jury, well, yeah, I did all these things, which is the equivalent of a demur. Now, a demur says, yes, I did it, so what? Factually, North is guilty, but legally he's innocent because Congress offered him a deal. He took the deal. He gave him the testimony that they wanted. So a deal is a deal. It's protected by the Constitution, and ultimately North is going going to be released by the Circuit Court of Appeals. My thinking on the matter was pretty plain and straightforward. I thought, you know, there was no point in taking this guy to trial unless it was for some political end. And there was no need for North to ever get on the witness stand, to ever produce a single witness, or to ever defend in the case. If there ever was a case for remaining silent and using the get-out-of-free-jail card, this was the case. But he didn't do that. He went in and made a full-fledged defense, spilled the beans about everything, put on witnesses, evidence, and testimony, spent $500,000, or so he says, complained bitterly about the excessive cost and the fact that he had immunity, and then they forced him to defend. He never had to defend anything. All he ever had to do was get on the witness stand, swear his oath, and say, I got this immunity from prosecution from Congress. Now, dismiss. And if the judge didn't dismiss, you take it to the appeals court and say, boys and girls, I got immunity from prosecution. Nothing more to say. Well, now remember, jury selection and other legal gyrations delayed the opening arguments until 1988. And Meese and the other guys, now Meese, remember, is a Republican in a Republican administration, and you'd think that they wouldn't prosecute. All Meese had to do, you know, here's the Attorney General, is say, we can't prosecute this guy, he's got immunity. Now the defender, Brandon Sullivan's response was simple and direct. His client never broke the law. He acted within the law at all times. He followed the instructions of the highest-ranking officials of the United States of America. He protected the secrets that he was ordered to protect, to save the lives of many people, many sources, many relationships. That's what he was ordered to do. And he followed his orders as any Marine Corps officer and any officer that worked at the National Security Council would do. Now, Sullivan painted a stirring portrait of North as a Vietnam War hero whose personal valor under fire had led to the heady promotions that came his way. Now, the biggest problem facing prosecutors was that most of their witnesses were unswerving admirers of North, with testimony couched in such a way as to impart the facts without leaving any doubts as to which side they were really on. Contra leader Adolfo Calero was typical. Quote, he North became sort of a savior. The Nicaraguan people have a tremendous appreciation for this man, so much so that they're going to erect a monument for him once we forget about him. Rarely has a prosecution witness for a nominated just to the judge. Only not going to take a break here. We'll be back. Everyone, you're listening to The Law Hour. I'm your host, George Gordon. Now, The Law Hour is an educational service in the public interest sponsored by Truth Radio Network. All of these Law Hour programs are archived for your listening convenience on the internet at georgegordon.org. That's georgegordon.org. You know, under the terms of a contract called the Old Covenant, it was negotiated by Moses out at Mount Sinai. You and I are entitled to 33 articulable benefits such as rain in due season, multiplied gold, silver, herds, flocks, and great wealth. Well, George Bush Sr. and his son, George Bush Jr., back in 1992 and in the 2000 election, said that what Americans wanted, though, was jobs, jobs, jobs. But you know, that's not what George Washington, Thomas Jefferson, Ben Franklin, Moses, or God had in mind when they wrote our Constitution, our Bill of Rights, and the Ten Commandments. All of these authorities recognized that real wealth is measured in land, cattle, gold, silver, wheat, corn, beans, honey, and oil. That's called jobs, jobs. And that's because there's no money in employment. The money is in private business. The money is in sales. There's no money in public business, and there's no money in jobs, jobs, jobs. Now it's time that you and I cashed in on our inheritance and learned how to collect our benefits under the old covenant contract, and to collect those benefits in gold, silver, wheat, corn, beans, honey, and oil, also known as real property, instead of credit, debt, usury, inflation, and more worthless paper. Now, if you'd like to learn how to do just that, why don't you call for more information on my CD Home School for Adults? That's the business school. And while you're at it, order my free general law CD package at the same time. That's a four-hour commentary on the law in general. It's informative, it's entertaining, it's educational, it's free of charge. And you can call right now. The number to call, 417-273-4967. And if you're online, why don't you go to the website georgegordon.org, click onto the email machine, and then send me an email request for that free general law CD package. Remember, that's georgegordon.org. Or call direct, it's 417-273-4967. All right, Oliver North, the get-out-of-free-jail card. North was well-liked by even the prosecution witnesses. And former NSC advisor Robert McFarland, North's immediate superior, took the stand, and already having pleaded guilty to four separate charges of withholding information from Congress. He was reluctant. He was evasive. McFarland had a knack for framing his answers in language and syntax that was so arcane as to render them incomprehensible. One of his few unambiguous responses came when Kuiker asked, "Do you ever recall hearing the President of the United States, Ronald Reagan, instruct you or anyone else in your presence to lie to the Congress?" "No," McFarland replied. "About anything?" "No." Probably the witness more eagerly anticipated than any other was Fawn Hall. Fawn Hall was Oliver North's former secretary. A media favorite, she told of deliberately shredding papers at North's request and also smuggling documents from North's office. "I placed them inside the back of my skirt so that they were secured there. Those reporters present, hoping for elaboration on this last tantalizing tidbit, were very disappointed." Hall, yet another witness clearly under North's spell, said nothing further to harm him. When North testified, he did so with the same confidence that had served him so well at the congressional hearing. The first part of his testimony comprised a condensed version of the $25,000 a night speech that he had been making lately to boost coffers for his defense fund. In a brief geopolitical slideshow, North sketched a picture of the United States under assault at every border. He explained how only the efforts of himself and other like-minded Cold War knights had kept the Western world safe from communism. Asked by Sullivan how he regarded his position, the defendant replied in the tremulous voice that had become his trademark, "I felt like a pawn in a chess game being played by giants." Now, there were missing funds, so the prosecution determined to keep the jury's attention on the charges and not allow them to be swayed by appeals to their emotions, began by probing North about $300,000 in traveler's checks, which had passed through his hands. "Where would you keep careful track of it?" In what kind of a book?" asked Kuiker. "In a ledger," answered North. "Is that ledger still around?" "No, it was destroyed." "Do you know who destroyed it?" "Yes." "Who?" "I did," North admitted. Equally suspicious was the source of $15,000 in cash, which North kept at his home. He insisted that it came from his pocket change, dutifully deposited in a metal box every Friday evening, over the course of 20 years. Well, Keeker was incredulous. The change in your pocket grew to $15,000. North said yes. In building their case, prosecutors had compiled a large dossier on North, detailing his occasional economics with the truth. That groundwork paid off. Over 4 days of cross-examination, Keeker repeatedly trapped the defendant in an endless succession of contradictions and deceit, especially on matters of money. When North left the stand, the aura of selfless patriot had been replaced by one of artful dissembler. Well, in the wake of this mauling, Sullivan did a masterful job of damage control. He returned to and expanded on the theme of North as a victim. I draw the conclusion that the president was using Ollie North as a scapegoat. Sullivan concluded on a biblical note, greater love has no man than that he be willing to lay down his life for another. That's Ollie North. That's the kind of man he is. Well, now it was up to the jury, and they retired on April the 20th. 12 days of deliberation produced not guilty verdicts on every count save three. It was a long way from the clear message that the prosecutors wanted to send. Their disappointment only hardened when Judge Gerhard Jessel imposed sentence, $150,000 fine, 2 years probation, and 1,200 hours of community service at the very least. The prosecution had been expecting some jail time. Well, North supporters rushed to pay the fine, but it was all academic. On July 20th, 1990, the U.S. Court of Appeals, citing that evidence used against North had been obtained under immunity, they overturned the convictions, wiping the stigma of felon from his name. So hero or villain, Oliver North's astonishing charisma and a carelessly enacted immunity pulled him through, and whether that makes his actions excusable is still open to debate. I don't know if his actions were excusable or not. That never was the issue. The issue was, did he have immunity or not? He either did or he didn't, one or the other. In this case, he had immunity, and so there wasn't anything to be tried for, but while Oliver North was complaining about his excessive expenses in his defense. Did you notice that he was getting paid $25,000 for speeches, that his supporters raised $150,000 for him to pay his fines? Well, I wonder if he ever gave the money back, or if this was a ruse to make money. Like I said, the only defense the guy ever had, the only purpose for making it was immunity granted by Congress. So that's the immunity card. Now, have you ever heard of a guy named William Kennedy Smith? His trial was broadcast live and direct. Came out of Florida. He's one of the Kennedys. I don't know why his name is Smith. He's some kind of a relative to the Kennedys. Well, he was charged with raping a woman on the front lawn of their mansion or their home down in Florida. He was exonerated. Many people said, well, that's what money does. Well, I didn't think so from what I'd seen and what I'd heard. One of the problems that the rich and the famous have is that there's always somebody that's seeking to sue them and make money. Well, Kennedy Smith got on the witness stand and he told his story, and they couldn't break him on cross-examination, so that tells me the story was true, because the most important weapon used in the courtroom is cross-examination. And the best thing that can happen is that your opponent lies about you. Because if he lies about you, any skilled cross-examiner can expose those lies on cross-examination. The worst thing that can ever happen to you is that your opponent tells the truth about you. Boy, that's a killer. Well, I don't ever want my opponents to tell the truth about me, but if they'll lie about me, I got them. Well, that's what happened in the Kennedy-Smith trial. It was a chance encounter at a Palm Beach, Florida night spot between William Kennedy Smith and Patricia Bowman. It led to the couple returning to the Kennedy compound overlooking the Atlantic Ocean. From the house, they walked down to the beach. What happened next would become the subject of worldwide headlines. According to Bowman, Smith raped her. Smith maintained that everything which occurred had been with Bowman's consent. The state, satisfied that Smith had a case to answer, filed rape charges against him. So here's something to keep in mind, boys. All a woman has to do is say, "You raped me." Now this ought to send a little signal to us. Did you notice that God told us not to practice adultery or fornication? Now, Kennedy Smith here was willing to practice fornication, maybe adultery. I don't know if he was married or not. Probably not. Maybe this woman was married. Maybe she wasn't. But in the least common denominator here, they both intended to practice fornication. Can you point to one example of fornication or adultery that has ever turned out good? Well, learn a lesson then. Well, when he rose to speak to the jury, the four women and two men, on December the 2nd, 1991, prosecutor Moria Lasch, I wonder why these people can't have names, you know, like Smith and Jones. Anyway, the prosecutor already had lost an important battle. Judge Mary Lupo had earlier denied the prosecution's request to admit the testimony of three other women who claimed that Smith had assaulted them between 1983 and 1988 on grounds that it did not demonstrate the discernible pattern of behavior required by Florida law for introduction. This meant that Lash had to pin virtually her entire case on the word of the accuser. First, though, Ann Mercer, a friend of Bowman, who had also been at the Kennedy house on the night in question, told the court that Bowman was literally shaking and she looked messed up. She said that she had been raped. When Mercer had confronted Smith to ask him how he could have acted as he did, his response, she said, was simply to shrug his shoulders. Well, in a blistering cross-examination, defense counsel Roy Black knocked gaping holes in Mercer's testimony. He forced a retreat from her earlier assertion to police that Bowman had been raped twice, that on one of these occasions, Smith's uncle, Senator Edward M. Kennedy of Massachusetts, had watched. Well, Black also got Mercer to admit that she had failed to inform the authorities of details that she subsequently revealed for the tabloid TV program A Current Affair. Gasp filled the courtroom when Mercer confessed that she had been paid $40,000 for her story by the tabloid. So by implication, Black suggested that Mercer's tale had been heavily embellished for monetary gain, and it was a stigma that the witness never fully shrugged off. Black drove home his advantage by playing Mercer a taped account that she had made earlier for the police that contained several statements that disagreed with the version that she had provided to the court. Then, in a surprise move, prosecutor Lash produced the accuser early in the trial to protect her identity. TV cameras obscured Bowman's face with a blue dot. Following the trial, Bowman elected to abandon her anonymity for a TV interview. Referring to the defendant first as Mr. Smith and later on as that man, Bowman described the alleged assault by saying, "I thought he was going to kill me." When Black chided Bowman for several lapses of memory, she insisted, "The only thing I can remember about that week is Mr. Smith raped me." Well, Black wasn't impressed. "I know you've been prepared to say that." Bowman snapped back, "I've not been prepared to say anything." Throughout his cross-examination, Black walked a fine line. How best to undermine the accuser's credibility without wishing to appear bullying or insensitive? On those occasions when his questioning provoked a tearful response, Black immediately backed off and suggested a recess. Under his deft probing, however, Bowman did acknowledge a history of problems with men, resulting, she said, from having many one-night stands. So the woman admits that she's a whore. And on rebuttal, Lash asked Bowman whether she had any ulterior motives for bringing the charge, and Bowman replied, "What he did to me was wrong. I have a child, and it's not right. I don't want to live the rest of my life in fear of that man. And I don't want to be responsible for him doing it to someone else." I got to pause here. I can hardly contain myself. This guy, Kennedy Smith, goes out to a bar. Back for the closer. You're listening to the Law Hour. I'm your host, George Gordon. Now, the Law Hour is sponsored by Truth Radio Network. It's an educational service in the public interest. Your support of Truth Radio Network and of our advertisers and sponsors is very important to us. So for more information about Truth Radio Network and Truth Radio programming, please go to our website. It's truthradio.com. Again, that's truthradio.com. And Truth Radio Network is a private volunteer organization established as a private charitable trust for the purpose of exercising and defending free speech. Truth Radio is not a 501c3 tax-exempt institution, and donations are not tax-deductible. If they were, we wouldn't be free to tell the truth. But your financial support is what we rely upon to help us pay for that satellite time, internet audio streaming, and our overhead costs, so we thank you very much for your financial support. It comes through your donations that you make to Truth Radio, P.O. Box 344, Napomo, California, 93444. Again, that's Truth Radio, Post Office Box 344, Napomo, N-I-P-O-M-O, California, 93444. Here's tonight's wise old saying: you cannot strengthen the weak by weakening strong. All right, we're talking about William Kennedy Smith, the rape trial. Remember this woman? Her name was Bowman. Bowman complained. And she said, "Gee, I've got a child. And what he did to me was wrong." Well, I can't believe that this woman is down here at the local pub, and she goes out with this guy. Now, I presume that if she's got a child, she's married, but then, you know, she may have been divorced, separated. And she's looking for a little fun and frolic on Friday night. Now, when a woman, whether she's married or single, leaves a bar with a man and goes to his home, what did you think they were going to do there? Look at old videos of old movies? Or did they go there to get her introduced to Senator Kennedy? Or, you know, didn't they go there to have sex? Wasn't that the purpose for this program? Now, this final comment brought back, or Black rather, the defense attorney to his feet objecting, and Judge Lupo ordered the remark stricken from the record. She called it inappropriate. Well, curiously, the prosecution called Smith's uncle, Senator Edward Kennedy, as a witness. Now, if, as some observers believed, Lash was attempting to visit some of the senator's perceived foibles upon his nephew, then she sorely miscalculated. For some 40 minutes, Senator Kennedy managed to recreate Camelot in a Palm Beach courthouse, as he evoked memories of the family's numerous tragedies. Nothing he said was remotely helpful to Lash's case. Not for the first time, the prosecution's strategy showed signs of being ill-conceived and poorly executed. Now, much of the defense was built around forensic testimony. Charles M. Seeger, an architect, said that given the house's construction, had Bowman screamed, as she claimed she did, the sounds would have been clearly audible indoors, and yet no resident admitted to hearing anything. Rather less successful was Professor J. Siegel's testimony, and he stated that sand found in Bowman's underwear most likely came from the beach, which tallied with Smith's version of events, and not the lawn, where Bowman claimed that she had been raped. Lash then bored in. Wouldn't you agree that a 6'2", 200-pound man running up a beach is going to churn up some sand? Siegel agreed. Lash went on, and if the defendant was wet, some of that sand would stick to his body, wouldn't it? Well, besides having to concede this possibility, Siegel also was forced to admit that the lawn itself actually contained a significant amount of sand, thus rendering his testimony virtually useless. Well, it took William Kennedy Smith just 29 minutes to tell his side of the story. Black concluded the brief account by asking if he had at any time raped his accuser. No, I did not, Smith replied firmly. Lash went on the attack. What are you saying, that she raped you, Mr. Smith? Later, in reference to an alleged second sexual encounter, she leered, what are you, some kind of sex machine? Smith weathered the assault coolly. He reiterated his story that the evening had turned ugly when he had inadvertently called the accuser Kathy. She sort of snapped and she got very upset. And later he said Bowman apologized as she was leaving the compound. I'm sorry I got upset. I had a wonderful night. You're a terrific guy. Minutes later, however, she was back crying and claiming that he had raped her, repeatedly calling him Michael. Frustrated by Smith's matter-of-fact responses, Lash adopted a different tack, claiming the Kennedy family was trying to engineer a cover-up. Smith would have none of it. If you're implying that my family is lying to protect me, you're dead wrong. Someone else, less than impressed with this line of questioning, was Judge Lupo. If you ask one more question along these lines, she told Lash, you'll not get away with it. Failure to abide by this instruction will result in legal action. It was a humiliating rebuke for the prosecutor, coming as it did with Judge Lupo's oblique reference to the fact that she suspected Lash might be angling for a deliberate mistrial, thus salvaging her case for another day. In closing, Black said, they want us to believe that this young man goes up there and rapes a screaming young woman under the open windows not only of his mother, but of his sister, two prosecutors from New York, and the father of one of them who is a former special agent for the FBI, making no attempt to apologize for his client's self-confessed dishonorable behavior on the night concerned. Black still appealed to the jury to exhibit general human common sense. Now, Lash could dwell on only inconsistencies, referring to Bowman. She didn't know this man. She didn't even have an opportunity to know him. This woman has had a child. She's a high-risk pregnancy. If she was going to have consensual sex on March 30th, 1991, she would use birth control. I got to pause here for a second. Who's to say that she hadn't taken a pill before she went to the bar? And what evidence is it that she's a high-risk pregnancy? And what kind of a slut leaves the bar? She admits she's got a child. Where was this child while this woman was at the bar being picked up by Kennedy? And I'm not here defending Kennedy. Kennedy is a lout. who was at the bar looking for a woman to pick up so he could take her home and have sex with her. You know, one hand washes the other and it takes two to tango. What you got here is a whore and a whoremonger. And the whore accuses the whoremonger of rape because he's famous and wealthy for the purposes of making money, as evidenced by the fact that she collected $40,000 from a tabloid. Couldn't contain herself, could she? She's actually going after the big money, like this guy, Michael, call his name, that Michael, that queer guy from Los Angeles. I forgot his last name now, but he's a famous, he just got charged the other day for assaulting a child. Now, he's been through that drill before, and he looks like the kind of guy that's a pedophile. He's been charged with that. He paid $10 million to shut the last pedophile. Michael Jackson is his name. Now, he's a celebrity. He's worth, you know, he's probably worth $1 billion or more. And he's a target. I don't know if the guy's guilty or not. He looks like he's guilty to me. Just looking at the guy, just listening to the guy, would tell you that he's a pedophile. He's some kind of a creep. Is that the kind of guy that you'd want your kid to spend an hour alone with? You'd have to be a lunatic to leave a kid with a guy like that. Anyway, getting back to reality here, the moral to the story is all of these people with money are targets for opportunists. And Jackson may be innocent. And maybe, just maybe, he's the target of another opportunist. But he acts like a pedophile. He looks like a pedophile. He sounds like a pedophile. He was interviewed on 60 Minutes or 2020 here on TV. I wouldn't let one of my kids get close to that guy. I don't think anybody else that was concerned about a child would either. How the parents of this child that was allegedly molested let their child get into such a compromising position is beyond me. The same thing is true here. This woman was asking for it. If there was ever a case where this woman's asking for it, maybe she got down the beach and said no. Maybe he did rape her. My question again is, why in the world did she leave that bar with this guy? They had never known each other before. There isn't anything proper about this. And maybe she got raped, and Kennedy Smith raped her down on the beach. Well, if he raped her on the beach, why did she say he raped me in the front yard under the windows with about 10 people in the house, including some FBI agents? See, her story doesn't make any sense. And after all, that's what she testified to. That was her story. Smith, on the other hand, never denied that he had sex with her. He admitted he practiced fornication. And this was the penalty or the payback that he got for it. Famous people have a problem that way. Let's just be pragmatic and realistic. Well, millions of viewers watched this drama played out on their television screens. For most, it was their first glimpse of the extraordinary problems that attend date rape cases. And by its very nature, this kind of rape will always remain a question of he said, she said. In such circumstances, courtroom demeanor invariably decides the day. Well, on December 11th, 1991, the case went to the jury, and after deliberating for just 79 minutes, they returned with a verdict of not guilty. I'm not surprised. What I'm surprised is that it took 79 minutes. It was one of those kind of open and shut cases. All right, we're taking a look here at American Trials of the 20th Century. Let me give you a plug here for the book itself. I don't know what the price is. The wife goes into Barnes & Noble, and she buys these books that we review here on the Law Hour, the editorial review. I wouldn't rate this book as being much above a 1 in 20 book. I've read a number of books like it. In fact, over here in my library, I probably have 20 books. But the thing that's unique about this book is that it has approximately 200 cases in it, 200 of these types of cases. I'm only going to read, you know, or review here maybe 7 or 8. It's published by Visible Ink Press. It's called America. Back to 3 minutes. We'll be back with news and views.